This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, we wade back into the tipping wars. What happens when a famous car service app decides to introduce tipping?
That's actually 60% of people, 60% of people never tip once.
Or when a famous restaurateur gets rid of tipping.
Well, I think the biggest thing we've learned is that this is really tough.
And why tipping, as controversial as it may be, isn't likely to go away.
They're wrong when they say that, but they believe it.
It's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. Last week on Freakonomics Radio, we started a conversation about tipping, a common act in America, if not in many other places. And we heard several arguments against it. From, for instance, Uri Ghanizi, an economist at the University of California, San Diego.
It's really a very strange behavior that we seem to be acting according to some kind of norms. And these norms are very hard to follow.
We heard from the Cornell tipping expert, Michael Lynn.
Both groups, blacks and whites, will tip a white server more than a black server. And that's even controlling for perceptions of service quality.
The restaurateur and Shake Shack founder, Danny Meyer.
The theory has always been in the tipping system that the only way I could possibly get someone to be nice to me or to bring my food promptly is, you know, to create a scenario in which they know that I will either punish them if they don't or reward them if they do.
And John List, an economist at the University of Chicago.
So you had people like Mark Twain saying, we pay that tax knowing it to be unjust and an extortion.
List is also chief economist at the rideshare service Lyft. It's the same role he used to hold at Lyft's big rival, Uber. As I'm guessing you know, Uber was one of the most successful startups in history. Before it went public this year, the company was valued at more than $80 billion. Its stock price has since fallen, but still, a massive company and a controversial one, too. Its founding CEO, Travis Kalanick, was forced to resign after a series of acts unbecoming a CEO. Another Uber controversy? Its drivers, who are independent contractors and not employees, often don't make much money. So John List, when he was chief economist at Uber, he saw an opportunity.
Prior to 2017, you know, Uber did not have in-app tipping on the platform. You might have had some situations where people were giving cash tips, but it was something that did not go through the Uber platform.
Actually, List saw two opportunities: to give Uber drivers a chance to earn more money and to run a huge field experiment on tipping. There was one big obstacle: Travis Kalanick, the company's CEO. How did he feel about tipping?
Travis had a pretty strong intuition that was a little bit like Mark Twain. He viewed it more as a tax or an increase in price because he felt that everyone would feel compelled to tip because it will become a social norm.
We should note that Lyft, Uber's biggest rival, did allow drivers to be tipped to reward good service.
You know, Travis was fine with rewarding great service, but he wasn't fine with social pressure leading to people transferring some money to another person. So really our first job was to assuage Travis.
Assuage him that tipping on Uber would be truly optional and not a social pressurized default option.
He made arguments that, look, if say 10 to 20% of people tip on the Uber app, then I'm going to consider that a win. So we went back to the drawing board and said, okay, what do we need to do to make sure that tipping on the Uber app does not become the social norm in that we can get roughly 10 to 20% of people to tip?
In other words, that was your target? You weren't going for 50, 100%?
No, our goal originally was to make sure that this was not a price increase, and loosely that meant 10 to 20% of the rides.
And if it got much higher than that, it would just be a tax. Is that the idea?
That's correct.
And I'd like to know, especially because in many cases, workers receive tips because their employers don't pay them enough. And in some cases, employers have been known to take a cut of those tips. What share of the tip in this case, if any, goes to Uber itself, or does it all go to the driver?
So the entire tip goes directly to the driver. Uber or Lyft, neither of them take a commission on the tip.
So John List, along with Uri Ghanizi and two more economists, Bharat Chunder and Ian Muir, turned the sprawling Uber ecosystem into a gigantic tipping experiment. How gigantic was it?
So in total, we have over 40 million observations of people.
All ages, all ethnicities, all income levels almost, all over the country, not knowing that they are taking part in an experiment.
And of those 40 million observations, we have roughly 800,000 drivers in our experiment.
So how did List, Ghanizi, and their fellow researchers set up tipping on the Uber app? Remember, they were directed to not make it automatic.
Okay, we need to separate the act of tipping in space and time from the actual trip.
And that's important. Why?
If you take a taxi cab trip, the person turns around and you give them the fare, and then 90 to 95% of people add a tip on it. It's face-to-face, there's a social norm, there's a lot of social pressure to give a tip in that situation.
So here's how Uber tipping was set up. The app generally wouldn't give a passenger the option to tip until they were out of the car and until the driver had given the passenger a rating, which the passenger doesn't see, by the way. So neither the rating nor the tip would be contingent on each other, which meant no quid pro quo, especially because unlike a waiter or waitress in your favorite restaurant, the odds are you will never see that Uber driver again.
The fact is that very few people meet twice.
In the biggest cities where Uber operates, there is a less than 1% chance that the same driver and rider will ever be matched up twice. So, Uber tipping is presumably not about social pressure or reciprocity or extortion. Instead, it's supposed to represent true appreciation in monetary form of good service. So, how appreciative are Uber passengers?
So a first fact from our data is that roughly 15 to 16% of Uber rides are actually tipped.
Think about that for a second. That's about one of every six rides that gets tipped versus about six of every six restaurant meals. So not great news for Uber drivers thinking they'd be raking in tip money, but good news for John List and Uber, who, remember, were shooting for a 10 to 20% tipping rate. Now, let's get into what List learned about the tippers. There are three categories here. Passengers who always tip.
Only 1% of people tip on every trip.
There are people who never tip.
That's actually 60% of people. 60% of people never tip once.
So that leaves 39% who sometimes tip, yes?
Exactly. You're talking about people who are tipping one out of eight times.
Okay, so 1% of Uber passengers treat the ride like a restaurant meal, automatically adding a tip. 60% are saying, no, thank you. I've already paid for the ride, so I'm not going to give you more of my money, which, if you're even a little bit anti-tipping in general, sounds pretty sensible. But then 39% of passengers tipped occasionally. Does that mean that Uber successfully made tipping about exceptional service?
So one of the most surprising results is that when you look at the data pattern, it's actually the rider variables that are roughly three times more important than the driver variables.
Let's translate what List said out of economist speak. What he means is that the biggest factor in whether a passenger tips is simply what kind of person the passenger is. That is a bigger determinant than the driver or the car itself or the route.
So if I unpack that a little bit, the first thing you can think about is the star rating.
Remember, just as Uber passengers can rate drivers, Uber drivers also rate passengers.
The riders who have a five-star rating, they're more than twice as likely to tip than riders who have a 4.75 rating.
What kind of passenger has five stars?
You know, they're punctual or they're nice in the car. they're giving respect to the driver.
Okay, and these five-star passengers happen to be the same people who are most likely to tip every time. In other words, they're just wonderful people. But there aren't that many of them. Just 1% of Uber riders. So, who are these generous souls? What kind of person is most likely to tip an Uber driver? For starters, they are most likely to be male.
A man is about 19% more likely to tip than a female rider.
Now that's an interesting finding, especially because it is the opposite of what John List's own research shows about charitable giving.
Women consistently across the entire distribution give more money to charities than men do.
And why is Uber tipping so different?
My intuition is it's because this is anonymous. The world of charitable giving tends to have a lot of social pressure. And what the literature also has taught us is that women are much more likely to change their behavior in the face of social cues. My intuition would be if you looked at tipping to taxi cab drivers or restaurants, that the difference would not be as stark, and women might even tip a little bit more, conditional on having the same income levels as men in those cases.
Now, to what degree, if any, are you able to control for income of the riders in your study? It may be that the men are wealthier, yes?
What we do find is that riders from lower income areas tend to tip less than riders from higher income areas. But even after we correct or adjust for those income area differences, we still find that men do tip more than women.
You also write that tips tend to be higher during very early morning hours, between 3 a.m. and 5 a.m., and that these hours have a disproportionate percentage of airport and business trips. What it calls to mind to me is those trips may be being expensed and may not be coming out of pocket, and maybe people are more generous with tipping if it's not their own money.
I think you're exactly right. I think those can be expensed. What you also find, though, is that tips tend to be high on Friday and Saturday evenings. So this is the going out to eat and party crowd.
This may or may not mean that the consumption of alcohol makes people more generous. The Uber data cannot answer that question. So draw your own conclusions. But there is one huge conclusion the Uber data seems to point to. Most people, when given the option to tip, do not tip. And when they do, it doesn't have much to do with the quality of their experience.
The bulk of the reasons why a driver will get tipped is because of these things that are outside of their control. But that said, there are many things that the driver can control that do impact the tip.
For example?
For example, if you look at drivers with a five-star rating, they're tipped close to 50% more often than those with a 4.75 rating. So the quality of the driver matters.
It matters, but again, not very much compared to whether a given passenger happens to be a tipper or a non-tipper. Similarly, there are other trip characteristics that may affect tips. How the driver drives, for instance, which Uber can measure via telematics information from the driver's phone.
Hard accelerations matter. And if you have more of those, you receive less in tips. Hard braking matters. If you have more episodes of hard braking, you receive fewer tips.
The age of the car also matters a little bit.
Drivers in the old cars are tipped slightly less than drivers in the new cars.
And the language the driver speaks, which List measured by seeing whether drivers keep the language on the Uber app in the default setting, which is English, or they change it.
And what we find is that those drivers who change the default language, those drivers end up getting tipped much less as well.
One way to increase your tips as an Uber driver is to be female.
What we find is a really strong result that female drivers receive about 12% more than male drivers in tips. Now, what's interesting, though, is that both female and male riders tip female drivers more.
Earlier research of yours at Uber found a gender pay gap with men earning more, even though the algorithm is gender blind. I'm curious whether tipping substantially shrinks that gap.
When you include tipping, that difference reduces by about 13%. So you still have a pretty large effect. Now, the reason why it doesn't lessen by more than that is that tips are only about 4% of fares.
Okay, so cumulative tipping on the Uber app is only about 4% of the fare total. Yes, that's a lot less than the standard 15 or 20% tip in restaurants, but still, 4% of extra money on millions and millions of Uber rides, surely that's got to be good news for the average Uber driver, doesn't it?
Driver earnings actually do not increase, on average, because of tipping.
Wait a minute. How can that be?
What happens is, when you add tipping to the app, more drivers come online and they supply more hours, so that shifts out the labor supply curve. And just that shift alone, of course, decreases wages, but then you have tips added onto that that make wages roughly the same as what they were before.
John List and his fellow researchers did find one lever they could press to increase the net amount of tipping: changing the default setting of the suggested tip amount.
One trip might get a default of, would you like to tip $1, $3, or $5?
Another rider, meanwhile,
they might receive a preset of, do you want to tip $2, $3, and $5? And those defaults or presets matter a lot. Roughly 16.5% of trips are tipped when you have a low preset versus about 14.5% when you have a higher preset.
What's the median amount tipped, however, in the different options?
When you have higher presets, people tip less often, but they end up tipping more in the end. So if you want to increase tipping, what you want is a higher preset, within reason.
If Uber really wanted to increase tipping, it could, of course, manipulate the tipping environment. It could, for instance, prompt a passenger to tip during the ride, which would jack up the social pressure component and make it more of a have-to, like in a restaurant. After the break, as you heard earlier, the restaurateur Danny Meyer thinks restaurant tipping is a bad idea, so he got rid of it. We'll hear how that's going. And does the tipping scholar who wanted to ban tipping still feel the same way? That's right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance with a Name Your Price tool, providing information on a range of insurance coverage and price options. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And by Atlassian, whether it's providing a single source of truth for thousands of employees or managing projects from start to finish, Atlassian works to unleash the potential of all types of teams with collaboration software. More at Atlassian.com.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Danny Meyer grew up in St. Louis, and even though he's been in New York forever, he still exudes a Midwestern sense of hospitality. So while many of his restaurants, like Gramercy Tavern and Union Square Cafe and The Modern, are well-regarded high-end restaurants, the style of service is, like Meyer himself, Midwestern warm. This combination of warm service and good food translates into big tips for the waitstaff. You might think that Meyer, as the employer of the people getting these big tips, might like this, but you'd be wrong.
I decided to take on the tipping system back in 2015, and here we are in 2019, and we've learned a lot.
That's right. Meyer started to eliminate tipping at his restaurants a few years ago. His menus would say hospitality included, which meant that prices were higher, but you'd no longer have to add a tip to help pay the server's salary.
We never wanted to hire people who would only be nice to you in expectation of a higher reward.
We made an episode about it back then. It's called The No Tipping Point, if you want to check it out in our archives at freakonomics.com. As we mentioned earlier, Meyer's restaurant empire also includes Shake Shack.
I will credit Shake Shack with having inspired me to take this step in our full-service restaurants. There are no tip jars at Shake Shack, and there's no opportunity to tip at Shake Shack. If we can make the economics work where we're selling, you know, $5, $6, $7 burger, why in the world can we not make this work when we're serving you a $100 dinner at Gramercy Tavern? It just doesn't make sense to me.
The haphazard sense of tipping also doesn't make sense to Meyer.
Everybody practically leaves a tip in a full-service restaurant. Nobody leaves a tip when they go to McDonald's. Some people leave a tip in Uber. Almost everybody leaves a tip with a taxi driver. And so I think that whole social norm thing is very, very confusing to people. And I'm just happy to opt on the side of saying, you know, that price we put on the menu, that covers everything.
But Meyer wasn't only thinking about his customers. One of the biggest challenges of running a restaurant is retaining good employees. It's a business with a lot of turnover, and turnover is bad for business. One obvious way to keep your employees is to pay them well. The wait staff and bartenders at Meyer's restaurants were getting paid well, thanks to all that tipping, but the same couldn't be said for all the people who actually prepare and cook the food and wash the dishes and keep the place running. Meyer found that the tipped employees at his restaurants were earning about 2.5 times what the back-of-the-house employees made. Were they really doing 2.5 times the work? And the pay gap between tipped and non-tipped kept growing.
Every time menu prices go up, and they've only gone up over the course of my career, the tipped employee is making more because the tip is just a multiplier of the menu price.
This pay gap had a variety of effects. One was that the people who spent time and money training to be chefs didn't want to work as chefs.
We were seeing more graduates from the Culinary Institute of America, Johnson & Wales, the Institute for Culinary Education, applying for dining room positions than I had seen in my entire career because they realized they couldn't afford to live in New York and pursue the thing that had always been their dream.
The pay gap between cooks and servers also created ill will and led to high turnover in the kitchen.
I increasingly saw this divide growing and growing and growing between the compensation possibilities between tipped employees and employees that did not legally qualify to make tips.
What does Meyer mean when he says that kitchen workers don't legally qualify to make tips? Because you'd think one easy solution to this problem would be to simply pool the tip money and redistribute some of it to the kitchen workers. But you can't do that. One quirk of the hospitality industry is that restaurants are allowed to pay servers what's called a tipped wage, which is below the minimum wage, as long as tips make up the difference. This caveat is called the tip credit, and restaurants use it to lower their labor costs. But one restriction of the tip credit is that it applies only to employees who spend at least 80% of their time in a customer-facing role. So a restaurant can pool their tips and distribute them among the wait staff, bartenders, and hostesses, but not the kitchen crew.
I might think twice if I believed that the legislature was going to create a new law that permitted tips to be shared everywhere. That has not happened, but even if they did do that, it would still lead me to say this is not a professional way to treat people. Tipping in and of itself, I don't think fosters the professionalism that we're looking for in our industry. If you think about every industry where tipping happens, it's often not a full-time career. I don't tip my airline pilot or my lawyer or my teacher.
For all these reasons, Danny Meyer decided to eliminate tipping at all his restaurants.
We've converted about one every 4 to 6 months. We just have one more to go.
Okay, so let's talk about what you've learned.
Well, I think the biggest thing we've learned is that this is really tough. And it's tough because it's really a three-legged stool that we're trying to balance. How do you create a menu price that doesn't frighten away a prospective customer who's just casually looking up your restaurant online and may not understand that there will be no tipping on top of that? And then, did you actually compensate your team to the degree that you hope to? And now the third leg of the stool is, did you actually make enough money to cover all of the costs involved?
What can you tell us about your restaurant revenues before and after, hospitality included?
Well, I can tell you that our revenues are decidedly higher, but keep in mind, we started charging 21% more roughly on all of our prices. So if they were not at least 21% higher, that would be a big fail. What I can also tell you is that the compensation for our staff members, both formerly tipped employees and never tipped employees has also gone up quite a bit.
So if one of the goals was to even out the pay between the people cooking the food and the people serving the food, how much have you closed that gap?
Here's what I know, Stephen. The earning potential before we started Hospitality Included was 2.4 times more for tipped employees than for back-of-the-house employees. Today, it's 1.9 times more. So that's big. I can also say that the line cook wages, so the people who cook your food, have gone up 37%. Front-of-house compensation, formerly tipped employees, has gone up 8%. So we've been able to increase both, but we've obviously, in order to make some headway in terms of this discrepancy, have increased back-of-the-house pay by a lot more.
Right. And what's that mean in actual dollar terms for kitchen versus wait staff? Maybe you could use the modern as your example.
When we started Hospitality Included, in the aggregate, the front-of-the-house employees at the modern were making somewhere around $22 an hour. And today, that number is about $25 an hour. Believe it or not, a cook in the aggregate in 2015 was making just over $11 an hour. Today, they're $16.50 an hour. So that's a serious, serious hike.
Meyer didn't share with us any profitability figures, so we don't know the degree to which these higher wages are eating into the restaurant's bottom lines. But, at least in terms of wages, the Hospitality Included model sounds like it's working. Kitchen wages went up a lot. Even waitstaff wages went up a little, on average. But not everybody likes to be average.
Whenever we've converted a restaurant, we would experience as much as a 30 to 40% turnover in our legacy staff. And I completely understand why that is, because the way that you got a raise in a tipped house was to have stayed at the restaurant longer than anyone else, which meant that you got the lucrative Thursday, Friday, Saturday night shifts, you know, and it may have taken you 6 or 7 or 8 years to earn that schedule.
But the new no-tipping model made those shifts relatively less valuable, which for shorter tenured workers was a positive.
One of the real benefits is that you can make as much money working on a Monday night as on a Friday night, because the way we compensate our team is a higher hourly rate plus a revenue share model that averages out the entire week.
And there was another benefit.
I feel great about the fact that I no longer need to worry that the only way to get a great tip is to have a woman subjecting herself to leering men, or if I'm from a different ethnic group than the table that I'm serving, that I need to worry that they're not going to give me a good tip.
But if you think you hear a hint of disappointment in Meyer's voice, well, I'm not sure that's what we're hearing, but when he set out to eliminate tipping, he thought he was starting a revolution.
Yeah, well, we did not succeed at inspiring an entire industry to change its tune.
The No Tipping initiative got a ton of media coverage. It was easy to think that a lot of restaurants were following suit.
Not as many restaurants have moved away from tipping as you would get the impression.
That, again, is Michael Lin, the Cornell tipping scholar.
There are about 200 restaurants across the United States. It's just not as big a phenomenon as people say.
Nor is this the first time the no-tipping trend seemed to be catching on.
In the 70s and 80s, there was a comparable tendency for a couple of restaurateurs that got a lot of press for it to eliminate tipping. And some of them survived and continued that policy, but the vast majority ended going back to tipping.
Danny Meyer gets that.
I've been pretty zealous about how I think tipping actually holds people back. But I also understand that movements happen in a big way when the economics work for everybody. And I don't think we're quite there yet. I completely understand it's not working yet for everybody.
If you were just having the idea today, having gone through what you've gone through the first few years of trying it, would you try it again? Or would you consider this an experiment in progress that, while noble and smart, et cetera, is maybe too difficult, that there's too much status quo to overturn?
Well, I think that's a fair question. And the honest answer is I'm not sure. I think largely because of some of the notoriety of our making this initiative, that has actually brought an awareness to the legislature, which is getting very, very close, as I understand, to creating a situation where tips can be shared amongst everybody.
Even if such legislation were to happen, it wouldn't eliminate tipping. In fact, it might strengthen the tipping model. But Meyer sees another development that could kill the model.
Each time minimum wage goes up, restaurants that are continuing to have a tipping system have all raised their prices to keep up with the minimum wage increases. And then the guest is tipping 20% on top of that. So we're about one minimum wage hike away from a pricing advantage over other restaurants while we're paying our staff more. And I think that's the point when you're going to start to see many, many restaurants eliminate tipping.
But Michael Lynn at Cornell, who once told us he'd like to ban tipping, he's not so sure we'll ever see the end. Why?
Look, when I started doing research on tipping, I thought tips would be strongly related to service quality. But what I found was that about 4% of the variance in tips left by different groups can be explained by their ratings of service quality.
That is, in restaurants, as in the tipping of Uber drivers, there was a weak correlation between quality of service and tip. But Lynn discovered something interesting in his research. A lot of restaurant servers think there's a strong correlation.
About half of the servers in this country will say that they think their tips are moderately to strongly affected by the service they leave. They're wrong when they say that, but they believe it. And because they believe it, tipping, in fact, does provide an incentive to deliver better service for at least half of the servers in this country. So, yes, my opinion about the incentive value of tipping as a system of compensation has changed over time, although the facts haven't changed. I've just learned more about it and begin to think a little bit more sophisticated about it.
Okay. Did you follow that? Waiters and waitresses think their service significantly affects their tip, even though the data shows it doesn't. But because waiters and waitresses think it does, they act as if it does. And Michael Lynn found a similar dynamic from the customer side.
Tipping increases customer satisfaction. Customers expect service to be better under a tipping system, and that can bias their perceptions. I've done a couple of studies based upon recent restaurants that have eliminated tipping. So, for example, Joe's Crab Shack recently at several of its restaurants eliminated tipping. Most of them went back to tipping. Their online service ratings declined during the period that they had no tipping and went back up when they reinstituted tipping.
Does that mean the service actually got worse when there was no tipping?
I don't know. I can't nail down precisely why it occurred. I believe it has to do with customers expect service to be better. I know that customers generally like lower prices, and Joe's Crab Shack, when it eliminated tipping, it raised its prices.
This suggests that many restaurant customers are price sensitive and that they're so accustomed to seeing menus carrying a pre-tip price that they'd prefer to see the low price and then tip, even though they'll end up paying the same or even more. The human mind is a funny thing, is it not?
I'm less likely to want to just ban tipping now because the data I have suggests that customers are happier with tipping. The press mostly focuses on this from the standpoint of servers, but by far the largest group that's impacted by tipping is customers. As much as people might grouse about tipping, overall, it seems to increase consumer satisfaction. And since they outnumber employees by a wide margin, likely it's in society's benefit.
So Michael Lynn's research suggests that Danny Meyer's no-tipping revolution will have to wait even longer. But Lynn's research did identify one category of restaurant that's ready for the transition.
And that is really upscale restaurants that replace tipping with higher menu prices.
Any examples?
Danny Meyer's restaurants fall in that category. I think that the price sensitivity of his customers is lower I also think that he's got a strong enough reputation that people won't anticipate lower service quality. It's a Danny Meyer's restaurant. People will still expect good service, even if there is no tipping.
So what have we learned, other than the fact that tipping is among the most unpredictable economic activities on Earth? I went back to John List to ask whether his research on Uber tipping says anything larger about the human condition.
I think a first point that the data really highlight is that very few people will be continuously generous and consistently generous. I think that that just jumps out in the data. I think a broader point number two is a heterogeneity across people. You know, we oftentimes have people talking about, you know, well, everyone's different, but we actually have a really good glimpse of an important part of our economy, and it shows you just how important things like, if you're a nice person and you get a nice rating, that spills over to this generosity that you can exhibit privately. I think that's sort of interesting because in psychology and in economics, we found that a lot of behaviors don't spill over to different areas in our lives. So, you know, you smoke, but then you wear a seatbelt. You're nice in one setting, but you're mean in the other. This sort of gives you a glimpse that there's some consistency in this generosity or being nice to another person that is much stronger than what I've seen in the past.
John, what kind of a tipper are you?
I'm an always tipper. I'm the 1%.
And why is that? Is it that you want to give some of your money to those people, or is it that you want to be for yourself the kind of person who does that?
I think it's both. I think that this is an important time to send wealth or income to another person who's doing a job such as this, but I also feel good about doing it. I have a warm glow, and it makes me feel good inside that I'm not stiffing the person.
If John List is telling the truth, and I have no reason to think he's not, this is interesting that an economist of all people always tips. Economists, famous for knowing, as it said, the price of everything and the value of nothing. Economists who lecture the rest of us about utility and profit maximizing, about putting aside our pesky emotions when it's time to make a decision.
I have a warm glow.
A warm glow? The fact that an economist like John List always tips is, I believe, the best possible evidence of just how weird tipping truly is. Coming up after the break, if you decide to open a restaurant, how to handle tipping is just one of many things you'll have to worry about.
A restaurant is a harsh mistress.
And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast on any podcast app, or you can see the entire archive on the Stitcher app or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, designed to provide information about available home insurance options in one place. More information at progressive.com. And by TransferWise, a new way to manage money across borders. Over 6 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, spend, and receive money internationally. More at transferwise.com/freakonomics or on the app.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Kenji Lopez-Alt grew up in New York in a family of scientists, and he went off to MIT to study biology. He got a little bored, maybe burnout, and during the summers started working in restaurant kitchens in Boston. After college, he worked in an architecture firm for a bit.
For a few months, like half a year maybe.
And then back to restaurant kitchens.
My very first restaurant job was at a place called Fire and Ice. It's a Mongolian grill, so I was a knight of the round grill. I stood in the middle of a giant cast iron grill and cooked stir-fried food for people and flipped asparagus tips into the air and stuff.
Over the next several years, he worked in a series of higher-end restaurants in Boston.
You know, after that, that was the end of my culinary career, or my cooking career.
He began building a career as a food writer at Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen. Then, on the food site Serious Eats, he started a column called The Food Lab. he wasn't expecting to turn into a food writing rock star.
I absolutely wasn't expecting it. You know, I was a freelance writer living in a one-bedroom apartment with no windows in Brooklyn at the time.
Now, after doing all that and having that platform and enjoying it, what made you think it was a good idea to not only get back into the restaurant business, but open your own restaurant?
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, it's that temptation you can't resist. It's like, oh, what if I just went back into the cooking for a little while? Would I be able to do this? You know, so I had a daughter. She's 17 months old now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And when she was born, my wife and I decided that she would continue to work and I would be the at-home parent. So I've been a stay-at-home dad for the last 17 months. You know, about like 6 months into that, I was approached by some friends of friends who owned a bar in San Mateo near where we live. And they were interested in opening up a beer hall and they were looking for a chef partner. And so I thought, oh, you know, this might be something fun I could do in my spare time, which, you know, you don't have too much spare time with a baby on your hands, but thought this could be something fun and this is a good opportunity, relatively low risk. Mainly it was because my wife and I sort of longed for a place like this in San Mateo, family-friendly, casual, upscale place.
Okay, so the restaurant is called Wursthall, W-U-R-S-T. Why a German beer hall? Why was that the right concept? Or why was that the concept they wanted?
Well, it's two factors. One of them is the space itself. We're located in a really nice old historic building, lots of nice light. So it seemed very conducive to this beer hall atmosphere. The other thing is that my partner, Adam Simpson, he is really into beer. You know, and finally, beer halls are kind of just popular right now. So it seemed like a concept that worked in the space, that worked with Adam's knowledge base. And it seemed to be something that was hot and kind of lacking in the San Mateo area.
So far, so good, right? So for everyone out there who's thinking, hey, maybe I should open a restaurant, we asked Kenji Lopez-Alt, what's the first step?
So the first step to opening a restaurant is don't. Opening a restaurant is a series of putting out fires every single day. Even once you're open, it's still a series of putting out fires. Step one, don't.
Okay, so can you walk us through the opening process? What kind of work goes into those preparatory weeks, months, I assume?
So the first step is you have to have a reason for people to believe that you're going to succeed and to give you money to do it, because it's not cheap to open a restaurant. And then from there, it's, you know, working with the architects and designers and doing all the build out, which inevitably takes way more time than you expect. And for us, we had this extra problem because we're in this really old building and the previous tenants and the landlord, they didn't take the best care of the space. You know, but working back from my side, from the kitchen perspective, initially a lot of it was conceptualizing, like, how German do we want to be? How California do we want to be? Because we knew we sort of wanted to do both.
So now he got to work creating a menu.
I had developed the initial opening menu on my own in my home kitchen before we had even hired any sort of kitchen staff. And I had like I'm pretty methodical. So I had like a recipe booklet written out, everything done in metric units, something that anybody could look at and replicate. You know, part of the idea was like, because it's going to be relatively low priced and high volume, the kitchen has to be able to sort of run itself, even without like very, very minute oversight.
What about the sausage making itself? I mean, that's a big component. Can you just talk about how involved you were in the design and execution and maybe experimentation and figuring out how to not only make the sausages that you wanted, but how they were going to be prepared?
Yeah, from the start, you know, we knew that we weren't going to be able to make the sausages in-house because we didn't have the facilities. So very early on, we decided, all right, we're going to have to find some partners to work with who can execute our ideas at a level of quality and volume that we're happy with.
Is that an easy thing to find, someone who can handle that kind of quality and especially volume?
No. I mean, the sausage part was mainly me going to every single sausage maker I could find in the Bay Area. You know, we did want to keep it local. We've, you know, visited many, many butchers and sausage makers, and there are many, many bad sausages around. You know, sausage making is a non-trivial skill. You think, okay, it's just meat and fat, spiced, ground up, stuffed into a casing. Like, how hard could it be? But it's one of these things where, like, the minutiae of the technique can make a huge difference in the quality of the final product. You know, it mainly comes down to the binding element, like making sure that you have the right level of salt and that it's the meat has been salted long enough that the proteins start to dissolve before you mix it, making sure that you mix it right and that you have the right ratio of fat to lean, and then also making sure that it stays chilled through the entire process. And if any one of those things is off, your sausage doesn't bind properly. And that's what you find is the problem with most sort of mediocre sausages. Like, they could be flavored very well. They could be crazy and interesting, but if they're not mixed properly, they kind of crumble instead of having that sort of nice, juicy, snappy texture that I look for in a sausage. And so finding someone who can do that was hard.
So shortly before opening, you tweeted, in all caps, by the way, "Opening a restaurant is insane, and I don't know why anyone in their right mind would choose to do it." So what's going on in the weeks and days just before opening?
I can tell you what was on my head when that tweet went out. It was not actually related directly to the restaurant itself. It was more about its toll on my personal life, and particularly my family life and my marriage, because... restaurant is a harsh mistress. During those 3 months I was in there, I would wake up, take my daughter to daycare, go to the restaurant from 9 a.m. till 4, go pick up my daughter from daycare, bring her home, put her to bed, and then go back to the restaurant from 8 p.m. till 1 a.m. It had been like 2.5 months where I had been basically never at home. You know, I saw my daughter for a few hours a day, but I basically never saw my wife. We lost the chance to sit down and talk together. The only time I ever saw her was when we were with our daughter, so we never really had any alone time. It's very difficult when you're raising a child, like, to not be able to talk to your partner, not even have the time to talk about things related to raising the child. And the worst part of it was that no matter how well you plan and you think to yourself, all right, this is the amount of work I'm going to have to put into this restaurant, and I'm just going to say no after that. It's really hard to say no when there's like 40 people whose jobs rely on you making this a success.
After months of planning and a $30,000 plumbing problem they discovered only during a preview night for investors, Wurst Hall finally opened in March of 2018. Even then, there were plenty of new problems to be solved. One of them had to do with the pretzels.
So I'm also a partner at a bakery called Backhaus, and they make all of our pretzels and all of our bread. Really wonderful pretzels, but we serve them hot. So we were trying to figure out, how do we get these pretzels that were baked that morning and delivered to us, how do we serve them hot and fresh? And, you know, the obvious thing is, all right, well, when someone orders a pretzel, put it in the oven, let it get hot, and then we serve it. This was a problem in a couple different ways. One of them was that Backhaus, they were salting their pretzels before they came to us. What happens with pretzel salt is that it draws out moisture from the pretzels. So after 8 hours or so, some of the moisture from the pretzels beads up on the surface of the pretzels, and then it leaves these kind of splotchy, wet marks, which is not good. And the salt is all gone. So we're like, okay, so we have to salt our pretzel sorter. That's adding another layer of stuff we have to do. And the only oven that we have back on the line is next to the fryer station, and the fry guy is extremely busy with the potatoes, and we also do a chicken schnitzel sandwich. And so adding pretzels on top of that to him became very difficult. So for the early nights, we were firing pretzels to order in the oven, and that was another one of those things that, like, seemed like it's a thing that takes 2 seconds, but it just piled on to the likelihood that we were going to screw something up.
So what was the pretzel salting solution?
Well, we found a much more efficient way of salting them. So one of the cooks had this idea to take a squeeze bottle, cut off the top until it was big enough that pretzel salt could flow through it. And now what we do is we just spray the pretzels and draw a line, you know, trace the outline with the squeeze bottle, and that clears up all the space.
So what you just described, plainly these are things that most people who eat in restaurants would never, ever, ever think about.
And they shouldn't have to think about
it. But you have to think about it. But as you're describing it, it strikes me that you, being who you are and the way that you like to work and the way that you do take an empirical and scientific approach to food and cooking and so on, that you were driven to solve these problems and get it right. Is that often the difference between a restaurant that works and one that doesn't, which is that you have to be driven to constantly adjust, solve problems like that that are going to come up, Do most restaurants really try as hard as you just described?
Most restaurants really try as hard. Any good chef cares deeply about the quality, and any good restaurant owner cares deeply about the quality of what they're putting out. So I don't think I'm unique in that regard at all. I think maybe we tend to, me and my partners, Tyson and Adam, we have a lot of sit-down meetings where we analyze problems and try and solve them. So maybe we do that a little bit more than other restaurants. But, you know, that's my skill. I've worked for chefs that seem to have an innate skill to just be able to figure things out on the fly, you know, or be able to work harder and faster to be able to solve those problems. You know, people attack those problems in different ways, but any good restaurant owner is going to recognize those problems and try and solve it in their own way.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. If you want to hear more about the trials and tribulations of opening a restaurant, check out the full podcast episode. It's called Why You Shouldn't Open a Restaurant. You can find our entire archive of podcasts on Freakonomics.com, and you can always get the most recent episodes on any podcast app. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week.